Hey everybody, this is DJ Q for the Golf News Met Radio Network. We now return you to Jay's Place, already in progress.
All right, thank you, DJ Q, for bringing us that in such style. You are listening to Jay's Plays on the Golf News Net Radio Network. I am Jay Flemmer. Jay's Plays is brought to you by Swifties, All-American and Irish pubs across I-90 and I-87. Come on in, get yourself a big, big, juicy burger and watch the game and hang out with some of our beautiful Swifties girls. And by Spring 44 Vodka. It's the cold, crisp, clear Colorado spring water that makes all the difference in this triple distilled beauty. Spring 44 Vodka, spring for some today. All right, guys, before we get into golf, we're going to bring Jay Busby back, and we're going to talk a little bit of football. Dun, 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 dun. I guess I should be singing, like, Oklahoma's fight song or Michigan State's or Clemson's or something, because we're not seeing the Wolverines there. But here we go, everybody. We're going to do our football picks. Jay, you're going to jump on in with your thoughts. So
sure,
we're going to take the Packers at home plus one versus the Cowboys. What do you think? What have you seen out of the Cowboys? Is anything give you any hope whatsoever that they can win that game?
The only thing that the Cowboys have going for them is motivation. You know, they're one game out of the lead in the NFC East there. They could somehow still, after the garbage of a season, still somehow manage to win themselves a playoff berth. And so that is about the only thing that they've got going for them. I mean, they've got Dez Bryant, they've got Jason Witten, blah, blah, blah. I just don't think that they're going to be able to hang with the Packers in any sense. Aaron Rodgers is finding his form. He's finding his footing under him, and this is a game where he will be able to rack up some big numbers.
You know, now, Bruce, while we're on that subject, like, exactly how bad is the NFC East, or is it just that they keep beating up on each other?
It's bad. It is objectively bad. It's not a matter of them beating up on each other. They cannot execute with any consistency. There's not a quality quarterback in the bunch. The coaching decisions are strange. The roster decisions are strange. You know, I think that Philadelphia will come out of the NFC East, but it will not be anything that any of those teams wants to claim as a victory.
I thought that, too, so long as they don't have to play Mark Sanchez, okay? Right now, no matter what happens, okay, they'd be better off firing Sanchez and bringing in the Monkees. But all right, let's try the Jets at home straight up against the Titans.
Yeah, that seems like a really, really good chance for the Jets. The Jets are right there to the wild card hunt for the AFC wild card, and they've got to win because Pittsburgh is mean. Pittsburgh is tough. Pittsburgh is going to be tough to hold off, so the Jets absolutely have to take care of business against the Titans. Titans are, as always, a bit of a mess. I like Marcus Mariota a lot. I think that once we're starting to hit the wall, where it's the longest season that he's ever played, so I don't see the Titans posing much of a challenge, but, you know, you always have to figure in the Jets factor, which is whatever the worst possible thing that could happen, the Jets will figure out something worse.
Yes, S-O-J, same old Jets. Now, yeah. Mind you, though, to teach us what they're doing right, because there's so many good AFC teams, and the Jets were expected to be inconsistent but aren't. How come?
Yeah, it's a strange thing. You know, they're kind of the Jets are a little bit of an anomaly because you're expecting them to kind of be a mess. They've been able to hold it together. Ryan Fitzpatrick, against all odds, has been a quality, serviceable quarterback, you know, after the jaw-breaking incident of Geno Smith in the preseason. So, yeah, it's a situation where the Jets, they don't have to be great. It's the old line about, you know, two guys running from a bear. You know, you don't have to be faster than the bear. You just got to be faster than the other guy. And that's all that the Jets have to do is be faster than whoever else the Chiefs and the Steelers are really their primary competition at this point.
The Steelers have no pass defense. They've got an electrifying offense. Okay, but you cannot have a bad pass defense and hope to win, even if, you know, they got beat 39-30 by the Seahawks, and they had to score 38 to top the 35 of the Raiders. So, you know, there's a huge question mark there. All right, let's move on to the next one. Cardinals hosting the Vikings. We're going to go with an over 39 points combined.
Yes, I think that's a safe bet. I mean, these are two quality teams. Cardinals, obviously, much more so, but the Vikings are starting to get together. The Vikings have to win to keep pace with the Packers and make sure they hold on to that NFC North berth. I think that this will be one of the better games, if not the best game of the year, of the week, I should say.
I'm a little worried. Both teams hit the under in their respective games last week. They were routes, though. For example, the Cardinals beat the Rams 27-3. Next pick, the Giants on the road getting six at the Dolphins.
Yeah, that's a strange game because the Giants, again, you know, they're in the same situation where they have something to play for. The Dolphins, I'm not sure that they're necessarily, you know, they're in a situation where they had a brief moment there after they fired Joe Philbin where they had a little bit of a rally. But now at this point, they're at the this point of the season where they're starting to mail it in. So if it were any other team, I'd say it'd be a route. The Giants, though, you can never count on them. Again, much like the Jets doing what you expect to. So that's going to be a fun one to watch.
How is Tom Coughlin, known so much for his iron fist and iron will, having his team just mail it in? How is that happening? I thought he wouldn't permit stuff like that.
I think that the answer to that is that Tom Coughlin may not be maybe mailing it in himself. Tom Coughlin may not be long for a job with New York. I mean, he's gotten two Super Bowls. He's done well with them, but I think that they may have reached the end of a functional relationship there. So it is possible that this time next month, Tom Coughlin will have a very new address.
Now, terribly sad because he came into that situation and expectations were low. But he went out and he won two improbable Super Bowls, highly improbable, and he did it with grace and class, you know, in a very tough place to be a coach or an athlete. He's done exceptionally well. I wonder if fans, you know, are taking a little bit too long to give him the credit that he's really worth. He may not be as fiery or as brilliant or as much iconic as a Parcells, but he's accomplished as much.
Sure, sure. Yeah, that's the thing is, you know, you wonder about a guy like Tom Coughlin certainly deserves a little more notice or deserves a little more acclaim than he gets. But you're right. I think that the way that the Giants won those Super Bowls just by the kind of quirks that no one was expecting them to win. Even, you know, they were against the Patriots in both cases. They sort of steamrolled it, or they were supposed to get steamrolled. They didn't. So Coughlin doesn't quite get the acknowledgement that he deserves, much like Eli doesn't. So it's going to be interesting to see where he ends up next, whether he's able to put it together, and you know, hopefully he can find something interesting to occupy his time once he's done.
Another interesting thing being that the Parcells Giants were so dominant and were so overwhelming, and you know the Coughlin Giants were plucky and upstarts and overachievers.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, next up, the Broncos hosting the Raiders, and it's an even game. So I think, even though I worry about this one, because one of these days the carriage has got to turn into a pumpkin for Brock Osweiler, and please, dear God, nobody make pumpkin beer or pumpkin lattes, or get this one, okay, pumpkin-flavored Pringles, okay, that we're getting, they had a big sign up at Dunkin' Donuts where I live saying, last call for pumpkin, and everybody was like, yes, thank you, how to enjoy pumpkin beer, throw it in the trash, but anyway, Broncos even against the Raiders at home. What have you seen out of the Raiders this season? I worry a little bit about this pick.
Yeah, the Raiders, you know, they're getting better, which is good for the NFL. You know, I think the Raiders, anytime that the Raiders are good, I think it's good for the NFL because they're such a dynamic franchise, such an interesting franchise. And so it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun and it's interesting. And to see them do well. I think the Broncos, you're right. They're playing with fire here. They're hoping that their defense is going to be stronger than anyone else's and that their offense is just not bad enough to lose them the game. That the offense can just hold on to the ball while the defense takes care of business. So
why and how did
Oh, go ahead.
It's like, no, go ahead. You think this is A?
Well, I was going to say, I think this is that this Raiders team is a couple of years away, that this is a matchup a couple of years away from being a great matchup, but it's going to be a fun one.
How and why did the Raiders get so horribly bad for so long? And how could that possibly happen under Al Davis? You know, in the bad old days of Al Davis.
Yeah, that's your start. I mean, he choked the life out of that. You know, he just absolutely mismanaged that team from the start. Well, not from the start. Once he got a taste of power and things. I don't know the exact history of all the franchise, but
But anytime that you've got people in the front office who are not football people meddling with what goes on down on the field, that's where you start to run into the trouble. You know, you have to have, if you're in a front office, you trust your people on the field, you hire the best people to do that, you trust that you're not the person to do that. And anytime that those lines start to cross, that's when trouble starts. And you know, Oakland has just been decades worth of that.
You know, it's interesting you bring up all of that. I can make a book recommendation to you that you will carry with you for a very long time. You're going to love this one. If you want to study the old days of the NFL, and in particular the rise of Al Davis and those Raiders and all their battles with the Steelers, our good friend Kevin Cook wrote a book called The Last Headbangers, which is the story of the NFL from the drafting of Terry Bradshaw through Dwight Clark's The Catch. And the chapters on the Raiders of the 70s are outstanding, including such stories as before the Immaculate Reception game, Phil Villapiano's helmet didn't fit, so he banged his head against the cement block wall of Three River Stadium and raised a bump. Now it fit. To John Matuszak, his wife tried to run him over in the car, and so they had makeup sex on the floor of the Kansas City Chiefs locker room. And, of course, the story of Al Davis throwing Hunter S. Thompson out of Raiders practice when Thompson was trying to cover the Raiders one year and follow, you know, one team that he picked all the way to the Super Bowl, and instead he ended up picking, I forget whether it was Pittsburgh or Dallas, but it's a phenomenal book, you know, telling all of those stories. My other favorite one, of course, being that right before the Immaculate Reception, the Raiders were in the huddle and they're all going, okay, it's 4th and 10, they're on their own 40-yard line, knock it down. Don't go for the pick, and don't go for the big hit. And this means you, Jack. Yeah, I got it. Knock it down. Yeah, sure. Sure enough, you know, he tries to knock Frenchie Buco's head off. The ball goes to Franco. He runs in the end zone. But the best part is when Jack Tatum says, yeah, I saw Franco running by me thinking to myself, man, he sure is in a hurry to get to the locker room. And then Phil ran by and snarled, asshole, and I knew we were in trouble.
That's it.
Speaking of books, you have a new one coming out. And besides being an outstanding football writer for, is it Shutdown Corner?
Right.
Is that correct?
The football blog.
And being an outstanding golf writer as well, you also cover NASCAR. And in particular, you've written a book, and it's going to be published, I think, in February, on everyone's favorite NASCAR driver, Dale Earnhardt.
Right.
Tell us about it.
It's about not just him. But his family, his father was a dirt track racer back in the 50s, a guy who started out working the mills and got fed up with working in the mills, so was one of the first ever professional racers racing in North Carolina in the hill country there. And then through Dale Sr., the Intimidator, most people recognize him of a certain age, remember him. Even if you didn't see a race of him, you know the iconic image with the sunglasses and the mustache and the black number 3. And then right on through to today with his son, Dale Earnhardt Jr., who hasn't had quite the same success on the track, but he's been NASCAR's most popular driver, according to the fans, for 13 years running. So it's really something to see this family, how they started literally from nothing and is now one of the most recognizable names in sports.
Now, you know, one of the things that you may or may not agree with, but it happens, is that sports writers tend to say that the guys that you're watching are the greatest ever. The guys that you're seeing right now are the greatest in history. And we're supposed to sell that and make everybody believe it so that there's more excitement. But how much does NASCAR owe its culture, you know, and its rise to the Earnhardts? Because it does seem like perhaps they have become and were the first family of auto racing.
Right, yeah, very much so. I mean, what Dale Earnhardt Sr. did, it's ironic now that people are considering him the emblematic of the good old days of NASCAR, because when he came up, when he first started racing in NASCAR in 79 and 80, he's banging fenders with people, and people were saying back then that he was an upstart punk and he wasn't respecting the good old days of NASCAR, and now here it is, you know, 40 years later, and he is the good old days of NASCAR. So he very much had a lot to do with NASCAR. He sort of took all of the various disparate elements of NASCAR, you know, the outlaw image and the tough guy image and the speed and the victory that various drivers had, and he incorporated them all in himself. He embodied all of them together so that everyone had a focal point to either love or hate this guy. You did not have a neutral opinion on Dale Earnhardt. You either loved him or you hated him. And so, yeah, today's NASCAR, many people contend that it's kind of a pale shadow of those days, and those people have a lot to support their position.
What do you think was the most interesting thing that you learned about Earnhardt that the fans may not have known? And what do you think was the most surprising thing that you learned about Earnhardt that maybe
nobody
knows?
You know, there's so much. There's so many different things. He was a prankster. He really enjoyed playing pranks on people and just having fun. And you know, sometimes the pranks got a little vicious, but sometimes they were just in good fun. He would do things. At one point, you know, his team owner, a guy named Richard Childress, was in a porta potty at the Bristol Motor Speedway, and Dale goes and takes his truck and starts bumping it harder and harder until he nearly knocks the thing over with the shoulders still inside it. So, you know, that's pretty funny as long as you're not inside it. That was a good one. Stories like that.
And it's funny as long as no one had used it before he went in there.
Exactly. And the odds of that are pretty low. But, you know, he would do all kinds of things like this. He would show up. Their still exists his headquarters outside of Mooresville, North Carolina. It's called the Garage Mahal. It's just this sprawling.
I'm sorry, that's too good. That's brilliant. Branding department, we have a winner.
But fans would gather there and they would hang out there to catch a glimpse of him. And what he would be doing is he'd be mowing the lawn on his tractor. And he would see how close he could get to the fans who were standing there before they finally recognized, oh, wait a second, there he is right there on the tractor. I mean, he was very much of an everyman sort of guy, and he never gave that part of himself up. He was always working his land. He was always working with his hands. So, yeah, just a fascinating guy all the way around, and someone that we don't have any kind of present-day corollary to at all.
When is the book going to be released, and are you going to go on a reading tour?
Yeah, it's going to be out February 16th, right before Daytona. I don't know that we'll necessarily do a reading tour because the economics of today being what they are, you can reach a lot more people with Facebook and Twitter and with radio shows like yours than you can with a book tour. So we'll have a few events here and there. We'll probably have one in Daytona and a few others around if there is a demand or interest. But, once it comes out, I will be blanketing the earth with promotion for it.
Well, as an entertainment lawyer and as a journalist and a writer myself, I'm going to throw out the thought that I love doing book tour. I love going out and meeting all of the fans. I love going out and interacting with them, having fun, you know, putting a personal touch on it. You know, there's something to be said about the old grassroots. And besides, it's really fun. I get a charge and an energy about, you know, when I go to do the readings. Because you can see them, they're right there, you know, you can interact with everybody. It's more spontaneous. They can ask you questions and pal around. So, you know, obviously everybody tune in, everybody check it out. It's going to be a terrific book. But more than that, come out and see us because we would love to have you, okay? Heck, when I do my next one, if you want to come on in and be a co-host and a co-reader, I'll be glad to have you do that. Now, I understand you're writing a new book called Run and Shoot. Tell us about that.
Well, it's not really a new book. It's a novel that I've been working on. So that one is for down the line. We'll see how that one plays out going forward. It's a novel that I have been working on for a little while. And at some point soon, I will bring that bad boy back. But for right now, I'm just focused on this one. And once this goes and sells through, if I can go and parlay that into a novel, then that would be so much the better.
So let's get back to golf before we close out the show. What's next for you? Are you going to be covering the spring swing? Are you going to be out there before the Masters? Will we see you most of the spring and summer?
I will be, let's see, I don't know what my schedule is in terms, I'm going to be locked down with the NFL and the book for, you know, we're already in the 2016 season, aren't we? I mean, we got that big 10-day break before we had to get started back on the 2016 season. But I have no scheduled golf commitments until the Masters. At that point, I will be on full bore. I mean, I'll be writing about it beforehand, but in terms of travel, it's going to be mostly NFL and NASCAR until then.
Yeah, I'm finishing up football season, and then after the new year, I have to start up with hockey season as well, and cover hockey simultaneously through, you know, I will pick up golf whenever something newsworthy happens, you know, but shortly before the Masters, we'll crank it up. It's always fun to peek in on the Hawaii swing to give a little extra festivity to the post-holiday season, and of course, there's some great tournaments out in California to check in on as well. But I'll pick it up at the Masters. You know, now this brings up another one of those global questions that I like to ask, which is, was there ever a time as a writer where you were assigned to cover a sport that you pretty much had to start completely from scratch with, or close to it? And, you know, how did you bring yourself up to speed so quickly so that, you know, you were worthy of all of the great eyeballs that you got?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I've always been a sports fan, so I wasn't completely coming at anything from step one. But you know, with any sport, you have to be aware of what a sport's nuances are, of what its various elements of coverage are, of what's been done before and what hasn't been done before. So it's every sport has its own nuances, and that's the trick to learning where that line is, what landmines to avoid stepping on, and all of them have their own. I think that golf has its own special breed of fans who will absolutely light you up if you cannot remember what club Tom Watson pulled on the 17th hole in 1977 on that Sunday afternoon. So you know,
it's damn bad. Try covering hockey.
Yeah.
If you get golf fans, it's crazy. Try covering hockey. Of all the sports that you've covered, which one was the hardest one for you to learn and why?
All the sports I've covered, let's see. I don't know. Probably NASCAR was the trickiest in terms of learning because there's a whole level of technical expertise that you have to know, in addition to knowing and understanding the personalities at play there and the rules at play. You don't necessarily need to know how a helmet works or how shoulder pads fit together or anything like that to cover football. You know, with golf, you do have to know equipment, but I think with NASCAR, it's more pronounced having to learn that technical side of things in a way that you might not otherwise have to learn if you're just a regular fan.
Yeah, I'll echo that thought too, that golf fans are remarkably ardent and love their sport and have a great sense of history. But the rank-and-file golf fan is nowhere near as rabid for and as hungry for the minutiae that the hockey fans are. I mean, the hockey rank-and-file hockey fans know the instant the player's traded and what the impact is. They can cite you all of the stats, you know, and they can go back for years, right down all the way to the minor leagues and the international league. And I will say this, too, okay, of all the sports that I've covered, I don't think that I've covered a sport that is as difficult to play in there, and I have more respect for the athletes than hockey, because not only do you have to be a world-class athlete, you also have to do all of this while skating. So you got to be a world-class skater, and you have to do all of this while a guy your size or bigger is slapping at you with a weapon, okay, or is trying to careen into you at 100 miles an hour and knock you into the glass boards. And the speed of the game, the speed of that puck as it comes flying off of their sticks is remarkable. You know, I would go down on the ice and I would watch the boys take practice. And, you know, you would hear the slap of the shot, and before you could even react, it echoed off of the glass. And I kept thinking to myself, my God, if that thing ever hit me in the head, I'd be dead. I don't know how these goalies do it. But yeah, that was the moment for me. That and watching guys try to deflect pucks intentionally into the net is remarkable as well. How, you know, if they want to deflect it low, they angle the stick this way. Deflect it high, they angle the stick this way. It's been a lot of fun learning it. The good thing about hockey is it's a get-the-ball-in-the-net game, and I played a get-the-ball-in-the-net game. I was a soccer player. So it's not too unlike that. You know, you got to learn the plays and the cycles, you know, but it's nowhere near as impenetrable as hockey fans would lead you to believe. So,
right,
well,
right.
What's on tap for you personally in the coming year? You know, have you played much golf, and where are you going to try to play this year?
You know, I have not played a whole lot lately. You know, the book and work have been taking up much of my time. I will, wherever I end up going for the NFL playoffs, I'll probably throw my sticks in the car or on the plane. I am wide open to see what is available out there.
Well, when we come down to cover the Masters together, we're going to have to go and play one of the mornings early. Let's go play maybe Jim Eng's course over at the Creek Club or something like that, or maybe Long Shadow. But it's great to have you on the show. Tell everybody where they can read all of your stuff.
Yeah, the best way is to go to Facebook, facebook.com/JBusby, JAYBUSBEE. Same thing for Twitter, @JBusby, or JBusby.com. I got them all locked down.
Everybody, we're going to have Steve Smyers up next. Thanks so much for tuning in. Stick with us. I am Jay Flemma. You are listening to Jay's Plays on the Golf News Net Radio Network.
We're at the end of another great Jay's Plays show, but thank you all so much for joining in. It's no fun doing this to an empty room, but it sure is fun doing it for all of you guys, so thanks so much. I want to thank Fish for kindly letting me use their great music as the theme song for the show. Thanks, guys. I want to thank CyberGolf and Golf News Network, cybergolf.com/writerscorner, including me and all the other fine writers, and thegolfnewsnet.com/radio. Take us home, DJ Q.
Tune in next time for another great Jay's Play show on the Golf News Net Radio Network.
Thanks, guys. Catch y'all next time.